You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
In addition to that batting average away from home, the American League's best at 335, for whatever reason, Baines hit 341 against left-handers.
Whoa.
Look out! This game is tied, and it hits the facing of the roof. That is your major tape measure job. We saw Reggie put one over the roof here a couple of years ago. The last guy to do it was Lou Whitaker, of all people, last May off Bert Hooten. This one might put the White Sox in front. Kittle goes deep. Back-to-back homers. It's 2-1 Chicago. For Baines, his fifth. Now Kittle with his third.
Middays on the Score.
That indeed, Bob Costas doing play-by-play for the 1986 White Sox back-to-back home runs by the Hall of Famer Harold Baines and this man, Ron Kittle, who is on Twitter at Naked Biker. And he joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Kitty, how you holding up, man?
I'm doing good. I'm quarantined on my own property, and I'm loving it.
Well, it's good to hear, and it's a long story as to how we got involved in trying to do a deep dive here on the 1986 White Sox, but you're the perfect guy with whom to start, because this was the year that Hawk Harrelson took over as general manager, and I remember one of the first things he did was he decreed that the fences be moved back at Comiskey Park. Because in his words, he said, our thumpers can hit it out of anywhere. And you were definitely one of those thumpers. And then, instead of playing you in left field, he decided he was going to experiment with Carlton Fisk in left field. He was also going to use a Rule 5 draft selection on a young man named Bobby Bonilla, who was going to play some left field as well. What was your perspective going into the 86 season?
You know what? As soon as he got that job, it was like a big question mark in the sky because you know, he was very flamboyant. He should have never got the job in the first place, and he'll be the first one to admit it. I think he got that job in the barge room having a few cocktails. But, you know, we go to spring training. It was all about Hawk. It wasn't about the players. You know, he put on his cowboy hat. And I just talked to Harold like 10 minutes ago, and he goes, remember when he had his name on his uniform pants that he would wear in spring training? So it was a clown show to begin with. But you still got to go out there and play baseball and try to do as good as you possibly can. And you want to win for yourself and the team, not for the general manager.
How do you win ball games with a clown show going on?
That's really hard to do. I mean, we had some decent players. Hawk brought in Mo Drabowski, Dick Allen. And I remember this, you know, Dick Allen, obviously a great hitter in Chicago. Trust me, I followed him. I knew what he can do. Harold Baines, Greg Walker, myself, and we're in a batting cage, and Dick Allen was the new hitting coach, and he had a cigarette in his mouth, and he went into the batting cage with a cigarette lit. He flipped it to the side. He took five swings, hit five line drives, picked up a cigarette and said, that's how you hit. And he walked away. We never saw him for another 3 days. So, you know, and I'm going, so, you know, me being a smart ass, I picked up another cigarette butt, and I went in the cage. And I walked up on the pitching machine, and Sammy Hairston was pitching, you know, using the balls in there. And I walked up, like, every 5 feet I would hit. And, I mean, I was hitting the best I ever hit. Harold said, you should do that in the game. Just walk up on the pitcher. But, you know, there were more photo shoots with Hawk than there was good batting practice or anything else. It was just everybody, they're all nice people in baseball. You know, Mo Drabowski, Dick Allen, great people. They were just trying to make everything put in a mixing bowl, and hopefully it worked. And unfortunately, it didn't work. And I wasn't healthy. I left spring training with the worst shin splints I've ever had in my entire life. I hit the ball great. I had a poor average, hit some home runs, and I wound up getting traded on an iconic day in Chicago.
Not only did you end up getting traded, the story of the guy for whom you were traded is fascinating, because in December of 85, Britt Burns was part of a trade to the Yankees that netted them the Joe Cowley, not our friend Joe Cowley, but the big pitcher Joe Cowley, and catcher Ron Hassey. And then later in February, Hawk trades Ron Hassey as part of a multiplayer deal to the Yankees to bring back Neil Allen and Scott Bradley. And you'll hear Scott Bradley's name coming up in a second once again, too. And then you go back to the Yankees, and he gets Ron Hassey back. What was the obsession that he had with Ron Hassey?
Well, Carlton broke his thumb. So he wasn't catching or throwing the ball at the time. We needed a catcher. There's no doubt about it. Hassey was left-handed, so that was a bonus for his character right there. You know, that kind of all started when I was on second base, and it was called Turn Back the Clock Day. We wore the old vintage uniforms, and Jeff Thorberg was the manager. And I hit a double. I think I got an RBI on it. And Steve Lyon comes out and to pinch run for me. He goes, I'm pinch running for you. I think it was the first inning or second inning. And I said, BS, you get your butt back in the dugout before I kick your butt on the field. So he runs back in the dugout. The Torper brings him back out. He goes, no, we're pinch running for you. So I knew something was up. You know, that's just how that season was going. You bring it up to other Joe Crowley. During the early part of the season, they bring a basket for your laundry, your towels. You know, a clubhouse guy throws it in there, you know. And somebody come in there and said, hey, anything you want to go to the minor league, put in there. So Tom Seaver lifted up Joe Crowley and threw him in the bucket and said, take his ass. So, I mean, that's basically, you know, I don't think Fish should have ever been out in left field. You know, matter of fact, I was DHing that day. The first ball that went to him, it almost hit him in the face. And he comes in, and I can picture just now, he was flipping off Hawk Harrelson up in the suite while he was going back in the dugout between innings. So, I mean, it was a mess the entire time. You know, you never like to get traded. It was probably a blessing in disguise for me, but I never got to saw Bobby Bonilla play, so I couldn't tell you much about that.
We're talking with Ron Kittle here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. We're starting one of what I hope are many deep dives into the 1986 White Sox season. Ron, you mentioned getting traded. Was there anywhere in you some relief about going away from what you already kind of called a clown show here with the 86 Sox?
No, I didn't really. I wanted to go out there and win. I wanted to do good. I mean, I was hitting above 200, you know, I was really hitting the ball good, right at people. And, you know, that happens. I mean, you're not going to get hits when you hit it right at people. I think I had like 16, 17 home runs or something and wound up finishing second on the team, and I wasn't even there the rest of the season. But it's one of those things that you don't need distractions from up in the press box. You need to have the distractions in the dugout, let the players take care of it, and you go out there and play. So it was a mess all around. It wasn't fun, you know, but like I said, it was a great experience for me going to New York, playing for the Yankees with some great ball players and, you know, seeing what it is. And every team just wants to win. It doesn't matter what team you're on. They want to win and they want to do well. That's how baseball is.
The other significant occurrence was the firing of Tony La Russa. That was the guy that had led the 83 White Sox, and you think that he's going to get a little better chance than that 26-38 start, but there he went. Doug Rader gets two games before Jim Fregosi gets the reins that year. So what were your thoughts when La Russa was let go?
You know, if I remember right, and I'm pretty good at it, Hawk wasn't trying to get rid of Tony La Russa. He was trying to get rid of Dave Duncan, the pitching coach, because he wanted to bring in Mo Drabowski. And Mo's been working in a tavern for the last 40 years before that, and doesn't know anything about does he know pitching? Probably, but he didn't know the current players. And Tony stuck up for him. You get rid of Duncan, I'm gone. And that's exactly how it happened. And, you know, I said my piece to Hawk a little bit. I kind of blanked and moaned a little bit, and he goes, don't worry. And, you know, that's just a sign that, don't worry, you're gone next. And that's about how it all happened.
Did you guys sense? I mean, it sounds like you sensed that at the time that this was an argument going on in real time. You guys didn't find out about the Duncan LaRussa Harrelson connection afterward. You felt it while it was happening.
They did it on the tarmac at the airport. We were going to the airport. We were flying out of town.
Wow.
It was done that quickly. Well, you know, Fisk got traded when he was in Cleveland. I got traded or got released. Fisk got released in Cleveland. I got released in Detroit. You make these decisions to do things when you're out of town so you don't have the local media all over you. You know, you understand that. I know you do that. You're in the radio industry.
Yeah.
Nothing you want will happen at home. It happens somewhere else. And that's kind of how the story went. But, you know, I had some great teammates. It was a lot of fun. It was an experience. I moved on, went back. I came back to New York, from New York to play against the Sox. It was fun. It's just a game of baseball, and you got to move on. But I'm going to tell you what, it was a circus show there for a while.
You mentioned the name Tom Seaver early on, who could obviously be sometimes an irascible clubhouse presence. Then later on in the year, after you were gone, and I don't know exactly why and how this happened, but Whyhawk decided to add, in the middle of August, he adds George Foster and Steve Carlton, of all people, to this team, which is just, you start reading through these names, and every next one, you can't believe it. I mean, I'm looking at the roster, you're seeing those guys, and there's Kenny Williams' name. There's, and Connor noticed this, Nick Capra was signed as a free agent who became, you know, part of the organization for decades after that.
You know, when you're the boss, you make moves, big names, it makes you feel a little bit more important and popular. You know, instead of going down there and get Roomba Zimba or whatever the guy's name is that nobody knows. So George Foster, Steve Carlton, great guys. Over their prime, they come in, and Hawk was looking for a miracle. He was literally looking for something to make what a mess it was get a little bit better. Jim Fregosi, awesome guy. Love playing with him. Before I got moved on, it was pouring down rain one day, and nobody wanted to play. I mean, he goes, "Are you?" I go, "I'm a mutter. I'll go out there and play for you, Jim. You know, you just go out there and play. If I didn't feel good, I was hurt, I still wanted to play." And see, that kind of hurts. So if I ever had to play back part of my career again, I would let myself heal up before I went out there and did something, because I wasn't thinking what the future would hold. I just wanted at that time to go out there to help my team win a ball game.
How long would you have needed? Like if you're going back to whether it's, you know, 84, 85, 86, Ron, and telling yourself, you know, from the time machine, that you need to sit down, how long do you think you would have had to sit in order to have that healthy season?
Well, in 85, after, you know, my rookie year, 84, I think it was, I jumped into the picnic area of Old Sox Park, and I dislocated my shoulder. I picked the ball up, threw it into Scott Fletcher, and it popped back in the joint. So I'm done. They shot me up with about 15 shots of cortisone. I couldn't lift my arm for ungodly amount. I went down to Double A to do some rehab for a week. I did really good. I came back up, and I think I hit 26 home runs the second half of the season. And it was tough, because I really should have, because I'm paying for it now. I mean, I can't do hardly anything without my shoulder being calcified. I went to arbitration with it. It was ugly. The doctor stood up for me and said, no, he should not have played for the next 3 months. But, you know, I'm a young kid. I want to play. You know, I mean, can you blame me? I want to play. I felt sometimes when, even if I was sick or hurt, I could still get better than somebody else. And that might not be true, but if you take that attitude out of anybody who's a professional athlete in any sports, they're going to struggle. You got to go out there and say you can compete, but yeah, it's a mess. I got a bump on my shoulder to this day, and thank God the doctor, Dr. Corzad, stuck up for me and said, this man should have been in a splint traction for 3 months before he even went out and played, and they just let me play.
We're talking with former White Sox slugger Ron Kittle here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show, and I mentioned before that the name Scott Bradley came up. Scott Bradley was traded by Hawk Harrelson to the Seattle Mariners on June 26th. They received a player to be named later. Then on July 1st, the Mariners sent that player to be named later, Ivan Calderon, to the White Sox. Now, we all remember the arrival of Ivan with his, you know, the gold chains hanging out his hairy chest, his shirts all unbuttoned. And for whatever reason, I just gravitated to him. I loved his style. I loved watching him hit. He was a better athlete than he looked like he would be. He made some miraculous catches, the famous one in Tiger Stadium. There was some others that are memorable. But that was my dude. What do you remember about that brief time you spent with him?
I'm going to tell you what, I loved him to death. And one of the opening day, I think I played with him again in 89. So we're in California. This is a great story if you got time to listen to it. So it's opening day. We're playing the Angels out there. Doug Rader's the manager on the California Angels. So I'm up there to get to bat, and I hit a home run the previous time up there. So Ivan's coming up, and the pitcher, remember Bob McClure? He was a left-handed pitcher. He's pitching to Ivan. And he throws a curveball to Ivan 50 miles an hour. And Ivan gets hit in the leg with it. I think the ball hit him and just rolled down his leg. And Ivan started to yell at him. So he takes his helmet off and throws it at Bob McClure. But the helmet gets caught in his stomach, comes back and hits Ivan in the head. So Ivan thought the pitcher hit him. So all of a sudden, the brouhaha came out there. And, I mean, what do you got to do? You got to go out there and fight for your team. It's a brawl. So who's coming out to the going to fight? Doug Rooster Rader. And I go, oh, my God. So I tackled Rooster. I knocked him on the ground, and all of a sudden people are pying on me. And, and I'm sitting there like, I said, don't step on my glasses. And Rooster's on top of me. He goes, Kitty, if I would have known that was you. He goes, I'd have started kissing you on the face. You know, just... It's just team respect, you know, but Ivan he threw his own helmet and hit himself in the head. And I couldn't have not stopped laughing more than I could. But
Ivan,
he played hard. He had like 5 pounds of gold on him. I don't know if he ever took a shower, but he washed the daylights out of his gold chains to keep him clean. And he was prepared to play every single day. Sometimes you didn't see him during the day up until game time, but he was there to play. Unfortunately, he was killed down in his home country, and, it's all over with now.
You know, I ran into a guy in a bar who managed Ivan Calderon in Bellingham, Washington, in short A. And he told a story. He said the press box for the Bellingham field where they played, highest point in the city, that anywhere in that town you could see when you were up in the press box. They said they had a game that was about to start. It was like a 4 o'clock start or something like that. And Calderon was nowhere to be found. They had no idea where he was. So somebody in the press box yells at the manager and says, he's coming. What do you mean? He goes, I see him. And so he goes up to the press box, and Calderon is completely shirtless. He's zipping up his pants. He's wearing penny loafers with no socks, and he's sprinting as fast as he can down the middle of the main street in Bellingham to get to the field in time for the game. And when I've told that story to people who knew him, everyone's like, oh, yeah, I totally believe that.
Yeah, I've been in that press box in Bellingham. I know how tall it is. And I've seen Ivan like that many occasions. He never wore a T-shirt under his jersey. I mean, if he could have played naked, they would have let him. He would have played naked. It wouldn't have bothered him. But he still would have had his gold chains on.
Kitty, let me ask you one last thing about the Doug Rader, whose name has now come up twice. You said that Rader was the manager of the Angels. He was also the interim manager in 86 before Fregosi took over. Now, the Red Rooster, I'm told, had a habit, and I got to be careful of how we describe this, but I was told that anytime there was a birthday cake that might be sitting out in the clubhouse, he would leave a little present on it that was just sort of his thing. Is that true?
You know, I'm going to plead the fifth on that one, but okay. I'll tell you this one. So he's manager, and we got our butts tallywhacked one day. I mean, it was a bad tallywhack. So the guys were hungry. You know, they get fed now by professional chefs. You know, they're eating, they can eat anything they want any time of the day. I mean, we were lucky to have a chicken wing from Chicken Willie Thompson. So we had a big old aluminum thing of spaghetti. I'll never forget this. We got our butts kicked. And all the players, after the game, they were running up to go eat. You know, and they had money, but we didn't make the money they have now. So Rooster comes in the locker room, and he takes off his uniform pants, and he's in his jock strap. And my locker is the only one that can see into his office. So he's on a rant. He goes, "You guys want to eat?" Not counting all the words he said beforehand. He jumps up on the table, and he sits in this big old platter of spaghetti. Yep. And he doesn't say it. Nobody says a word. They kind of just sit down. And I'm in my seat. I didn't even go in the lunchroom. And Rooster's in his office. And I'm looking at him, and he's cracking up, and he's pulling spaghetti out of his butt crack.
Oh, yeah. Man.
He couldn't stop. He had tears in his eyes. So, you know, the coaches were right next to him, you know, where the old coaches, you guys were never in the ballpark over there. I had tears in my eyes for the next hour. I got tears in my eyes now thinking about that story. And at least to say, nobody ate that day. But, you know, he is probably one of the best baseball minds I've seen. He's like a Mensa. I mean, he's super intelligent, strong as an ox, great ball player. And, you know, what used to make him mad is when Terry Bevington came over, and Bevington couldn't remember his name. You know, if he's one of your coaches, you got to remember the guy's name. You know, yep. And I think, you know, he's resting down in Florida right now, probably having a great time in life. But I still picture Rooster with spaghetti hanging out of his butt.
Kitty, I could do this all day. I mean, seriously, I could absolutely do this all day. This did my heart good.
I remember everything in detail. I don't want to. This head is so full of useless stuff. You know, former players that I play with, they ask me, and I tell them, and they said, "How do you know that?" They said they couldn't even remember what they ate for breakfast. I don't know. I've always had that observation in my head. But, you know, it was sad that Tony left. And I've heard Jerry say this many times, that his two biggest regrets was hiring Hawk and getting rid of Tony. And I'm sure Jerry would attest to that. And they're great friends to this day because of that stuff. And, you know, Hawk's in the Hall of Fame now, so c'est be.
Well, this is all this stuff in your head, far from useless today. This is absolutely wonderful. I'm glad we did it. Ron Kittle, thanks so much, and good health.
Thank you, Ron.
All right. Have a great day, guys. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.